Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have won the election, and despite Donald Trump's ongoing hissy fits, tens of millions of Americans are celebrating this victory for democracy. Yet this victory is attenuated by the millions of Americans who still voted for Trump and the other leaders they have reelected to federal and state offices who are intent on undermining the very tenets of democracy. Today we talk with energy expert and social justice advocate Jenny Stevens, author of Diversifying Power, Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy, about why the future we are about to enter calls for a new kind of leadership sprouting from the grassroots. Jenny, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you. Great to be on the show.
Well, this is a very interesting week to be talking. Last week when I did this show, we were still waiting for election results, even though by the time the show aired, we had them. Or at least everybody thought we had them except for some of the Republicans. Today is Thursday, November 12th. We are still waiting for Trump to concede. In the meantime, I have these really powerful images from this past weekend, and I think that they're shared by probably many millions of people around the country. One of the images is of, I imagine, millions of people in the streets across the United States and across the world celebrating Biden's victory. I've never seen anything like that, any kind of celebration quite like that in my life. The other image I have is Rudy Giuliani standing at a makeshift podium between two small powered speakers in the parking lot of Four Seasons Total Landscaping in Northeast Philadelphia, proclaiming that the election was stolen and that they were going to be filing all these lawsuits. And then he finds out that Biden has been declared the victor by all the networks, as he sort of says, the networks, and most of the media. I wonder what you think about those two images and that juxtaposition.
Yeah, so I agree that those two images really elevate some of the unique moment that we're in, right? With this intersecting crises going on, and then we're in this pivotal moment of transfer of power, right? And the celebratory aspect and this optimism and hope that really was a rejuvenation, right, of a lot of things that many of us have been working on for a long time, and the relief, right, that was felt around the world, right? It wasn't just in the United States, because other parts of the world are looking at the United States and saying, what is going on over there, right? And particularly with regard to climate change, because the climate crisis is now so urgent, and then what happens in the next few years is so critical, and the harm that has been done in the past 4 years is so devastating globally that within the climate community, the global climate community, the relief and the celebratory sense was very strong. And yet here we are still trying to figure out how it's all going to play out. We don't want to be too celebratory too soon, right? Because there's still lots of work ahead.
I think that one of the parts of that split image that really bothers me the most is Rudy Giuliani's denial of the election results is an indication of how much baggage is still like we're dragging behind us from the last 4 years, if not the last century, in terms of climate change and a lot of other injustices. But it gives me a sense of just how difficult this job is. And I think, let's start with how do we get rid of the Rudy Giulianis, get them out of the way so we can actually move forward?
Yeah, you mentioned denial, right? And this has been a central political strategy of patriarchal leadership that we've seen over the past 4 years. Not only is there denial of the election results, but there has been denial of the climate crisis, denial of the dangers of the pandemic, denial of the economic crisis we're in, the housing crisis we are in. You know, really a strategy of denial is a delay tactic. It's a tactic to keep things the way they are, because the way they are right now, some elites are profiting from, right? And that is the strategy of denying the problems that we're facing, and also denying structural racism is another big piece of the conventional patriarchal leadership that we've been experiencing. And that is so problematic because it has resulted in systematic policies and processes that are not in the best interest of the people. And are really designed very explicitly and intentionally to be exclusionary and to continue to concentrate wealth and power among the elites who are profiting in the current system.
Well, it seems like for a very long time, the elites, particularly the fossil fuel elites, have really been in control, whether it's the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. But it seems to me that under 4 years of Trump, somehow the ugliness of the fossil fuel industry and that elite really came to the forefront. And I wonder if you think that that may be helpful in terms of getting people to understand just what we're really up against and to appreciate the connections between the fossil fuel industry and the way that they control government.
Absolutely. So one thing that I think has happened during the Trump administration, but also during the pandemic, is people have started to realize, and it's been kind of revealed, how, you know, this country that has so many resources, so much potential, has been, you know, not supporting its people in the ways that we need to and we could be. And I think the economic injustices and this widening income and wealth gap that is has been so prevalent that people are starting to realize even more and more how problematic it is, that has really been happening over the past four decades or so. And as you mentioned, the elites, particularly the what I call the polluter elites, those who have been profiting from the fossil fuel infrastructure, really they've been investing strategically to resist a transformation away from fossil fuels to a more sustainable clean energy system, renewable-based system. And they've been doing that through a strategy that many of us haven't been very aware of, but they've been investing in a misinformation campaign to deny climate science, so to confuse us about the risks and the dangers of both fossil fuels and the climate crisis itself. But they've been also been investing to undermine public trust in government and dismantling the regulations that have been, that are intended to protect us and protect our public health, and then also investing in minimizing worker protections and worker rights. So there's been a cultural shift in many companies to prioritize shareholder interests rather than employees' well-being. All of those shifts together have been eroding our policies and our culture and our political engagement and our civic engagement to the degree that we find ourselves where we are now, with so many Americans really kind of at a loss and not trusting the government and not being able to see the value and the necessity of public institutions, public investments, and the regulations that, that we need to protect ourselves.
One of the terms that came into play in the last few years was Kellyanne Conway's term, alternative facts, which is something I don't think we could have imagined the concept of that before Donald Trump. What was your response when you first heard that term?
It is shocking, and it's hard to understand and justify and understand how people can accept or be complacent to that. But I think on the flip side is that things have gotten so complicated, right? And there's so many different perspectives. Again, there's reasons why people believe certain things. And many of us want to believe things that resonate with our outlook on life. And there's been, you know, a lot of real strategic effort to connect with people in ways that are more about emotional or cultural connection and not about the facts or the science. And I think that this is where I think we really need to be concerned and about kind of broadening our approach to thinking, particularly about climate change. In the book, I talk about climate isolationism, which has been kind of the strategy of kind of keeping climate change as this separate issue that, you know, isn't what most of us wake up every day worrying about necessarily. Maybe we'll have time to get to it, but it won't be the top of the list of things. And people have also embraced on kind of a technocratic perspective, right, about decarbonization and greenhouse gas emission reductions and things that don't necessarily relate directly to, you know, we don't all think about our carbon emissions every day. So I do think there's also a sense of needing to broaden the conversations so that our scientific and kind of technocratic language does resonate with people in a deeper emotional way and connect with people. So one of the ways we can do that is really broadening the conversation about climate so that it's actually about jobs and economic justice and about housing and education and health. You know, those are the things that people do care about more. And so that's part of the idea too, is broadening the conversations and connecting these issues together so that people realize that our best chance to address them is actually in coalition with other issues, right? And looking for a kind of bigger structural change.
Well, one thing about language that I found interesting, Joe Biden the other day made reference to the climate crisis rather than calling it climate change. And to me, that was a big step. Even if he's still not going full on board with the Green New Deal, even though his program doesn't sound that different from it, I wonder what you think about that language change.
Absolutely. I think you're right to identify that as a shift, right? Because climate change sounds kind of benign, whereas a climate crisis has some urgency and it elevates it as something that we really need to be paying attention to right now. And I think here we are also in this moment with intersecting crises, right? We have the climate crisis, we have the pandemic and a health crisis, we have racial justice crisis with structural racism. We have an economic crisis. And these are the moments, the disruptive moments, like where we're in right now, where bigger structural changes could emerge, right? And I think that's really important. But I also think that there have been a few other firsts that are really important to highlight. If you remember the last debate, there was actually an environmental racism question where the facilitator asked both candidates, what would you say to Black families who are concerned about their health and their family's health because they live in close proximity to an industrial or fossil fuel facility? And that was very telling as well, right? In terms of the stark contrasts and how the candidates were able to respond to that and the fact that that's even a question. So that demonstrates kind of a mainstream appreciation for environmental racism and these links between racial justice and the environment and the climate crisis.
Well, another thing in terms of language, again, that struck me was Biden made reference to fence line communities and frontline communities and frontline workers, which is something that maybe months ago I thought there was only people in the environmental movement who even knew what those terms were. How did you buy it and find out about those words?
Once Biden got the nomination, he really brought people together and listened to the social justice advocates. And I think he deserves credit for, you know, being open to and integrating into his plan and his campaign the perspectives of particularly the youth. You know, the Sunrise Movement has really been critical in terms of coalition building and mobilizing and inspiring young people. You know, young people look at the future, and it's not just the climate crisis that they're worried about, but the economic prospects and their jobs. And I have two daughters myself at 19 and 21, and I see them looking to the future. And, you know, there's a lot to be worried about, right? And I think the Biden administration has really been open and been listening and bringing in different voices and perspectives. And I think as we hopefully move forward with the new administration, the work is not done, right? That's where I think we all need to make sure that we're all mobilizing and continuing to engage and hold accountable and push for the bigger transformative changes that are needed.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Jenny Stevens, author of Diversifying Power, Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. We're talking about why the future we're about to enter calls for a new kind of leadership sprouting from the grassroots. Well, you're talking about Biden basically taking some leadership from the grassroots. Do you see that is actually a big shift in your thinking and realization since you wrote the book almost a year ago now?
I've been working on climate and energy issues for most of my career, so 20, 25 years. And, you know, I see the climate energy experts and how they've been approaching the climate crisis and climate policy. And, you know, to be honest, it hasn't been that effective, right? We haven't been able to move the needle in the ways that we have needed to, that we could have 5, 10, 15 years ago. So I do think the timing is right for now. And I think the Biden administration is well positioned to be, you know, at the helm during this time of bigger transformation. We can no longer do small steps, incremental progress on renewable energy and moving away from fossil fuels. We need to be making big investments. And I think that's what the Biden administration has committed to. And it's an investment-based strategy rather than a taxing-based strategy, which I think is much more effective and much more what we need right now, because we really need to be particularly investing in communities and households and organizations that have been underinvested for too long, right? And that's where we have an opportunity to really center social justice at the core of all of the investments as we continue to struggle through this pandemic and as we move into a post-pandemic phase where I do think we'll have to have large public investments.
It's hard for me to imagine myself thinking a year ago that Joe Biden would be the person who'd be leading us through this transition. And when he described himself as a transitional president, I sort of got it and was really impressed. But it also makes me think about how when Obama was elected 12 years ago, people thought, oh, great, we've got a great president now. I'll sit back and just watch television again. What do we need to do to remain engaged? And do you think that more people get it this time than they did 12 years ago, that we can't just have a president we like, but we have to put pressure on him continually?
Yes, absolutely. I do think we learned a lot from the Obama administration and the hope and optimism. I remember the night Obama was elected. It was an optimistic time in another way. And I think what we need now is we are in a different moment. And I think we know people are very aware that we all need to keep up the efforts and the coalition building and the activism and advocacy, because we're in such a critical time. And what's really important, and this is where you know, I'm inspired by leaders like the Squad, in terms of the four junior congresswomen who came on the stage, in the last just 2 years ago, and really have changed the national discourse on climate and energy, because they explicitly have been able to connect climate policy with jobs and economic justice and racial justice and social justice and criminal justice and connect with housing investments and various different ways. So I think we are in a different moment, and I think it's clear to many of us that we have to continue the work. The work is not done in any way, shape, or form, right? Like, we are getting to a place where we can hopefully be in an environment with the national government that is at least is conducive to, but then we need to continue to press and be innovative along the way. And, you know, we're not sure yet what's going to happen with the Senate. So if the Democrats don't have a majority in the Senate, major legislation will be difficult. But that doesn't mean there's a lot of other things that can still be done, right? And so it'll be a different kind of strategy. But we still have some hope, and there's still some possibility that the Senate will flip as well, although it's narrow possibility.
This election in Georgia, which is actually two elections for Senate seats that are in runoff, is maybe a great opportunity for us to maintain the mobilization that really peaked during the presidential campaign. How do you see that happening, and what can listeners be doing to plug into that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all be paying attention and contribute and engage and help the mobilization efforts for the Georgia Senate races. And another critical piece that I think is so important, and I think this is where this idea of anti-racist feminist leadership is so important. What we really need to continue to ask for, demand, you know, put forward and support are candidates that understand the structural issues with systemic racism and gender discrimination and other all forms of this kind of hierarchical structural issues that we so many of us have been experiencing. And so one of the things that I think is really important is when we think about the leadership that we need to both be embracing and supporting those who acknowledge the social justice priorities and embrace anti-racist and feminist principles. And anyone can do that, right? Regardless of your gender or your racial background, religious background, cultural background, anyone can embrace anti-racist feminist principles. But it's also really, really important that we continue to diversify and have better representation of different kinds of people. And when women, people of color, and indigenous folks get in leadership positions where they've been historically excluded, we bring a very different sensibility to social justice, right? Through our different life experiences, our different perceptions of risk, and different sensibility and capacity to center social justice at the core of the policies and processes and practices that we are endorsing. So I think that is really key as we go forward with any and all future elections, and also just supporting leaders locally as well. And when I talk about leadership, it's not just the elected officials, right? We are all leaders in our communities, in our organizations, in our families, in our neighborhoods. And we really want to be and in continuing to support diversity in that leadership at all levels, and really encouraging people and helping people understand the agency that we all do have, especially when we work in a collective way.
As far as the House of Representatives go, despite the fact that I think so far there's 6 and there might be a loss of 8 seats, however, there were 3 wins that almost doubles the number of people in the squad. I want to talk about those races, who those leaders are, and what they represent to you.
So the squad has really been at the core of, you know, a lot of my inspiration. Chapter 1 in my book is called Growing the Squad, right?
And by the way, let's name who they are, because I'm not sure everybody knows who we're talking
about. So Ayanna Pressley from Massachusetts, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York, Ilhan Omar from Minnesota, and Rashida Tlaib from Michigan. Young women, they're all non-white women, women of color, who have really inspired so many of us. And by changing the discourse and have been speaking truth to power and just very practical, and you know, anything they say in and of itself does not seem radical at all, but how they're bringing in a very inclusive and participatory and collaborative sense. And Ayanna Pressley likes to say, you know, anybody who is committed to a more just future is a member of the squad, right? So the squad is an inclusive group. It's not just the 4 of them. And as you mentioned, several new representatives have been elected. But what's really key is that they are in contrast to kind of more conventional patriarchal leadership. They are really focused on distributing wealth and power, right? And investing in communities and workers' rights and centering racial justice, economic justice, social justice, so that we reduce inequities and disparities. And what's we all need to be reminded of is that when we are not paying attention to injustices, and we just kind of go along and think things are okay, we are actually perpetuating the injustices, right? Because things have gotten so embedded in our culture and in our political landscape that, and that's why the squad is so inspiring. And really what they're doing is they're really very clearly being able to link these different problems together to make the case, a more compelling case for bigger structural change, which I think is really important.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about the 3 new people that are in the squad. What I'm thinking is Cori Bush, who I think is from Missouri, am I correct?
Yes.
And I just heard her interviewed on the radio a few days ago, and she's very inspiring, and particularly it's her life story, which is so different from the life story of most people who make it into the United States House of Representatives or Senate.
Yeah, no, she is definitely inspiring, and she, you know, is really paved the way in new and exciting ways. And that's where, as I mentioned before, what's so unique about these new leaders is their different life experiences, right? And because of their life experiences, they bring to the job just such a different set of priorities and perspectives and perceptions of risk is another piece that I mentioned before. Yes, Cori Bush is inspiring for sure.
Can you talk a little bit about her life story? Do you know that much about
her? I don't, actually. I read a little bit about her. But yeah, maybe you can tell me.
I'm trying to remember. It's been a fuzzy week, so I'm not sure. She may be a single mother.
She is, yeah.
And she's basically been working all her life. And she's like a real working class African-American woman. And she has been organizing, I guess, all of her life, too. And I think that's something that we see with all the other, the original squad women, that they have been lifelong organizers. How does this inspire the rest of us to step up?
As I said before, I think we all need to recognize and take responsibility for the leverage and power that we each have, right? In whatever positions we have. You know, I'm a tenured faculty member at a big university. So I feel like I have, a privilege and a responsibility to contribute to and support these initiatives and these people and inspiring creative leaders that are really paving the way. And it's hard work, you know, especially the squad. They have been targets of misogyny and racist targeted. And I think it's very difficult. And I think that's where the power of numbers and the collective action is so important, because individually, a lot of people feel threatened by these powerful young women. So, you know, we need solidarity and support so that we can support each other and continue with the work and not be bullied by the hate that is out there. We all, in our own lives, in our own paths, careers, and communities, we have ways to take collective power and also lead to inspire others, right? I think that's also really important. Like, we can all be thinking about collective action and leveraging our roles to advocate for bigger systems change, which I think is important.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Jenny Stevens, who's author of Diversifying Power, Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. And we're talking about why the future we're about to enter calls for a new kind of leadership sprouting from the grassroots. I keep having images of those people in the streets across the world, and particularly across America, and saw pictures of people in Boston, where you are, and also my hometown, where you used to teach, in Worcester, Massachusetts, was the place when I was growing up. We'd have peace marches that had about 10 people in them. And I saw this wonderful array of people in front of City Hall in downtown Worcester. So, I mean, places that are not being seen as the centers of activism outside of New York and Detroit and Philadelphia and Portland and the other anarchist jurisdictions. What do you think, as you're watching all those people in the street, what is your hope that will be the next step after they stop dancing?
Yeah, so I think, when I see the people in the streets and when I've been in the streets, I love the phrase, this is what democracy looks like, right? And I think one of the themes of my work is this idea of energy democracy, which is acknowledging that our fossil fuel-based system has been concentrating wealth and power, and it hasn't been leading to local and regional control, ownership, profiting, and it has had disparate impacts on already underinvested communities. So energy democracy is this idea that we can envision a renewable-based future where we have locally appropriate, regionally appropriate mix of not just solar and wind, but on coastal communities, we could also have wave and tidal energy and offshore wind. In inland places, we could also have, in addition to wind and solar, we could have geothermal energy, which is a technology we've been underinvesting. And what's so powerful about these renewable futures is that it's revolutionary because every place and every region actually has access to renewable energy. So once you invest in leveraging that resource, you actually have plentiful, abundant, very reliable, almost free power. And so we can literally and figuratively distribute power. So I think what I am optimistic about, and where I think we can go with the mood we're in, some of us, you know, in terms of the celebratory and engagement, I guess, is the other thing. Like, people are really passionate and care right now. I think we need to make sure that the investments, any and all public investments that are made now and into the future, which I think we will need to make as we recover and continue to struggle with the pandemic and then the post-pandemic phase, we need to make sure that those investments are distributed in a way that lift up and are investments in people and communities that have been underinvested. And we need to move away from the fossil fuel reliance and the power and influence of fossil fuel interests to this more real democratic distribution of power, both electrical power and political power.
I want to talk about that other 71 million people who voted for Trump and what their fears are. This is a conversation that many of us have been having intensely for the last week and a half now. What can we do to reach them? And how can we help them to understand that what we're talking about is really in their best interest?
Yeah, I think once we have investments in what people need in terms of job training or new jobs, I think the conversation will change very quickly. We have been in a situation for the past few years where basically, you know, the government hasn't really been helping very much, right? But people are also mistrustful. So I think when we are able to reposition ourselves and really focus on a people's first and a community oriented approach to investing, then I think people will appreciate the possibilities. And I also think, you know, I think there was an exit poll or something I saw on election day that 70% of voters do support investments in clean energy and renewable energy. So the complexities of our electorate are such that people are you know, trying to synthesize so many different perspectives at once, and it gets very confusing for people. And there's a lot of different intersections of different things, that different priorities that people have. So I think we do need to connect and listen and learn from each other across the divide, and really demonstrate with very tangible benefits to people what the value of having strong, trusted leadership and government is. And I think that's really where there's a lot of, obviously a lot of work to do, but I think there's possibilities for sure.
One of the first things that Trump did while he was campaigning in 2016 for president was to call out how the Democrats were going to destroy the lives of coal miners in West Virginia, and I guess also in southeastern Ohio and Kentucky. And it resonated. And then to complicate matters, West Virginia's wonderful Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, who just completely blasted Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez right after the election for being a socialist and losing the Democratic seats in the House. There's this really entrenched power in coal country, even though coal is obviously a dying industry. But Trump and his Republican surrogates have been able to spin the anxiety and the fears of coal miners and other people who work in the fossil fuel industry. So how do we use the concept of a just transition to actually resonate with these people?
The first step is to demonstrate and commit to resources and support for those communities, right? And I think that's what, looking back in retrospect, you know, in the Obama administration, I think that would have gone a long way if that at that time there had been better and more robust and specific tangible benefits that were given to help those communities that were so threatened and concerned about the future. And so I think what we've seen is, as you mentioned, like almost a doubling down of that entrenched power as people feel more and more threatened, right? Because then they're like even more diehard and committed. But really, the realities of fossil fuels with the health implications and the inconsistent job prospects and the decline across the board, we really need to help those communities and provide very tangible benefits to those communities to transition and reestablish economic development tools of other industries, other jobs, And I think that's really critical and has to be a big part of the investments going forward.
Well, you mentioned in the last debate between Trump and Biden that when we were talking about frontline communities and fence line communities, Trump, who didn't seem to understand what the phrase meant, was talking about how those people have great jobs and make a lot of money who live there. And he sort of was maybe alluding to they might be dying of cancer, but at least they're making a lot of money. I wonder how that resonates with people who are living in those frontline communities. Do you have any contact with that or have a sense of whether that kind of rhetoric coming out of Trump actually makes them feel like they're being taken care of or makes them feel really frightened?
I've collaborated with a colleague who's done research on fracking communities in Pennsylvania and other states. You know, it really has been very inconsistent, the jobs, right? Like the promise of the local benefits and the jobs were there. But there's almost been, you know, a real kind of boom and bust cycle as well, where there might be some jobs for a few months or a few years even, and then it's gone again. And I think people have really felt that kind of being jerked around a little bit. And it's definitely not stability and it's not long-term prosperity. So I think we do need to acknowledge and address directly the suffering and the precarity of all of those communities. I think what's happened is the fossil fuel interests have really kind of leveraged that insecurity to enculturate this very adamant pro-fossil fuel stance, which is just tied to the prospect of this not such a great job anyway kind of thing. And really, I mean, the people who are really making a lot of money and profiting from fossil fuels are at the elite end, right? And not the communities and the workers. And that's very clear in the research and in what we can see politically as well.
Biden said that he believed that we needed to transition away from fossil fuel. And then he got this huge pushback from a lot of Democrats and supposedly liberals, as well as all the conservatives. And there was an interesting discussion, though, about how he just lost Pennsylvania. That's what I think Trump says during the debate. You just lost Pennsylvania. But then there were other people who were saying people in Pennsylvania aren't too crazy about fracking anymore because they're really experiencing its direct consequences. Which do you think is a more accurate picture of Pennsylvania?
Well, I think people see the writing on the wall, right? Fossil fuels are not a long-term good investment across the board. And I think that holds from what I've read about and the few people I know in Pennsylvania. I'm glad you raised that because that last little, what Biden mentioned about transitioning away from fossil fuels was actually a big moment because that was the first time a presidential candidate had suggested that and acknowledged that. And that is what we are trying to accelerate and you know, they say that acknowledging it is the first step, right? So I think that was a big moment. And that's why it became that kind of controversy. But I think it is, again, the writing's on the wall. Maybe we can, you know, with certain kinds of policies, you can hang on a little longer with the fossil fuel reliance, but it's, you know, not for the public good. And it's not, you know, benefiting most people.
There were very few Democratic presidential candidates who were that clear about transitioning away from fossil fuel. I think mainly Bernie Sanders. And then I think actually Kamala Harris had some statements about it. But when Bernie Sanders said it, it scares away the right. And it scares away, I think, a lot of people in coal and fracking country. There was something about the way that Biden said it that was kind of comforting. Did you get that feeling that that was not the same tone that we would be getting from Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, and I think it was because he has, during his campaign, he reached out and tried to understand. He met with Varshini Prakash, one of the leaders, the co-founders of the Sunrise Movement. So the youth movement that has had such a strong influence over the past couple of years on the climate issue. So I think he's very aware of that. And the reality is, and why so many people are afraid of it, is because the fossil fuel interests have so much money and they've been giving so much campaign donations across the board to different candidates. And, you know, that's another aspect of the squad stepping up and saying, you know, we're not going to take the money. But yes, I do think you're right that Biden kind of, I don't think he was planning necessarily to say that. I think it kind of came out in the, and Trump kind of goaded him on, in fact. And I think it came out, and you know, many of us were very glad that he acknowledged that, right? I think it was an important moment.
It was seen as a Biden gaffe, but if that was a gaffe, then I want more of them. Well, you're listening to Luckus Focus here on Cuba Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Jenny Stevens, author of Diversifying Power, about why the future we are about to enter calls for a new kind of leadership sprouting from the grassroots. Well, you're talking about the tainting of fossil fuel money in elections, and I'm thinking about a very disappointing congressional race in Washington State in the 10th District, where a woman who was formerly the mayor of Tacoma, who welcomed in the world's largest methanol refinery, she was hoping that that would get built in Tacoma. It was actually stopped by a huge grassroots movement. Then she moved on and was, I think, head of the Chamber of Commerce in Seattle after that. And she ran against a grassroots, very pro-environment, Green New Dealer, very progressive woman, and she trounced her. I mean, maybe not trounced her, but she won by like over 10 points. And there was a lot of fossil fuel money going into her campaign. And of course, that part of Washington State, which includes Tacoma and the great port of Tacoma, is just awash in fossil fuel money and influence. And it was very disappointing because that's a part of the country I've been watching for a while and really seeing that there's a real strong progressive movement there, but it just can't seem to make inroads into electoral politics. Do you have any sense about how to help communities like Tacoma to make a shift and really be able to elect progressive leaders who represent their interests?
Well, I think you just have to keep trying, right? And supporting the leaders that are trying and the resistance. I mean, and again, that's why I actually in my book, I elevate the stories of these inspiring, creative, innovative leaders. And many of them are up against these powerful, powerful interests, right? It might seem insurmountable, right? To be able to confront and resist these entrenched power dynamics. But what we're seeing, and this is happening in communities around the country, are weaknesses in that entrenchment, right? And it's all about timing and confluence of different things that might be happening in the community or outside the community during the time. So that's where it's so important not to give up and not to think, oh, that'll never happen. Because especially right now where we are with the pandemic and the suffering and hardship that is happening, we are in a moment where so much is being revealed about these problematic power dynamics, and we need more and more people to continue to call things out the way they are and stand up for what the investments in communities and families and people that we really need. So persistence is really, you know, a difficult thing, and it's tiring, and it can be very frustrating. But I think that's where you know, being inspired and learning about wins in other places, and then like being networked and connected, and then leveraging our collective power and continuing to fight for social justice. I mean, that's it. There's not really another option, right? But there's different strategies, and part of it is being opportunistic when there are. Opportunities to change the leadership. So I don't know the details of that particular jurisdiction, but that's the story, you know, across the country. There's very similar examples. And so some of them, you know, we hear some of the good news stories, but for all of the good news stories, there are these very difficult situations too. And persistence and camaraderie and solidarity is what's needed.
Well, I'm wondering, since you finished writing your book, you said just at the beginning of the pandemic last spring, it's become a cliche that time is spinning so quickly past us this year in 2020, and time has become an almost unimaginable thing to we can't comprehend. What have you seen in the course of the time since you wrote your book that either reinforces what you wrote or makes you really wonder where we go from here?
What we've been seeing reinforces what I think we need. One specific example is if you look to New Zealand, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, she is among the leaders who have been credited with being the most effective in the pandemic in managing the coronavirus. And similarly, other countries led by women, Taiwan, Denmark, Germany, they have been the most effective managing the pandemic, and they have It seems the strategy that's effective is taking evidence-based, decisive action and then communicating to everybody with compassion and empathy and trust why that's necessary, right? And it's not just about your own health or the health of your family, but also the community health and the even the health of the country, right? And that's the kind of leadership that we need more of. That's the kind of leadership we need on climate and energy as well as pandemic. And there is research that shows countries with more women in leadership positions have more ambitious climate policies and climate ambitions. So, you know, I think we're seeing a lot of evidence to support the idea that having more diversity in our leadership is essential for coming together and collectively developing strategies and plans and policies that more effectively help us navigate a turbulent future, right? Like, and with the climate crisis, we can expect more big disruptions, right? With more frequent and intense climate disruptions of all kinds, as well as the political disruptions and turmoil that we're going through. We need a commitment and leadership that really can focus, as I said, evidence-based with compassion and trust, and also with a commitment to what's in the collective good and the public good.
Well, there's also this issue about empathy. And obviously, what you're saying is that women leaders tend to show more empathy and to be able to communicate that much better than a lot of the traditional male leaders. And that's one of the things I've been having a conversation with a number of my friends about. How do we find empathy with people who voted for Trump? And do you see a way that we can use that whole concept of being able to get into somebody else's headspace, get into their shoes or whatever, to understand their lives so that we're not just making each other wrong, and that we could role model that to Trump supporters so maybe they can understand why we believe in the things that we believe in?
No, absolutely. And I do think empathy is essential for us to overcome the divide that we have in our country right now. We all have different mechanisms or ways to kind of work on internalizing what that actually means for us. But I think the worst thing to do is to villainize or demonize, right? Like another person's perspective. And everybody, and again, I think that's where, for me, it comes back to understanding and appreciating and acknowledging that, you know, everybody is in a all Americans are in a tough spot right now, and people are afraid, and they have a lot of good reason to be afraid. So when we're in vulnerable positions and we're afraid, we often might grasp for something that gives us, that seems to resonate and give us some hope. And so I think we need to acknowledge that in a way that is, as you said, empathetic, and work on demonstrating with very tangible kinds of proposals and you know, I mean, everybody wants healthcare. Everybody wants good education for their kids. A lot of people, 70% of people want clean energy and want public investment. So, you know, I think we've been in this time of such intentional division, right? Like we've all been manipulated to be divisive. So we need to resist that and come together with compassion for each other and understanding and respect for the fear and the vulnerabilities that people have. And then trying to work on rebuilding trust and trying to come up with a shared vision for a more prosperous and sustainable future for everybody.
One of the gifts of the pandemic has been that this is the first time, at least in my life, and probably many people who are alive now, that everybody on the planet is experiencing the same ordeal. And it creates this commonality across all kinds of boundaries and all kinds of differences. And a lot of people think that it was the pandemic which opened up so many Americans and then people around the world to the horrors of what Black people experienced that was so underlined by George Floyd's murder. And there was a while where over 70% of Americans were supporting Black Lives Matter. Now, that kind of diminished after a while, and I think some of the fault can be laid at some of the ways that the protests kind of disintegrated or degenerated. But I think a lot of it had to do with propaganda. I wonder how we get back to that place back in the beginning of June when people understood injustice so clearly and were ready to go out in the streets and actually ready to risk their health to demonstrate in the ways that they did. How do we get back there and how do we move forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have seen, as you said, a great increase in awareness, more than awareness, like a commitment and a passion for elevating racial justice. And I think I guess I would say, you know, maybe we can get back there, and maybe we're not that far from there, but that the fears that emerged during the electoral time kind of took precedence over some of that commitment, I think. So I think, you know, now we're in a place where with new leadership that acknowledges and has connected these different crises of structural racism, the climate crisis, the pandemic, and the economic crisis. Kamala Harris and Joe Biden have acknowledged and are committed to all addressing all four of those crises together. And so that is where elevating the possibilities for centering social justice and racial justice and economic justice at the core of our pandemic response efforts, of the core of our climate crisis response efforts, is so critical. And I think people are, I think we're in the right moment in a sense. You know, there's academic literature that talks about how big societal transformations happen, and you need big disruption of the status quo, and that's where we are right now. And you also need experimental, innovative, inspiring things happening at the grassroots, and you need macro level disruptions at the big level. And that, you know, we are in that moment. And so that's where I continue to be optimistic about how so many people are right now being able to connect these issues. And when we connect, think about these crises together, I think we're better positioned to work toward more structural and changes that could be actually transformative.
And hold the Biden-Harris administration's feet to the fire.
Absolutely. That's essential.
Jenny, thanks so much for talking with us today. It's been really great to talk to you. I hope we talk again soon.
Yeah, thank you so much, Barbara.
We've been talking with Jenny Stevens, author of Diversifying Power, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and would like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO, or renewing your membership if you are already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the Donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper and Danino Rourke with 350 PDX about frack gas pressures on the Columbia. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll celebrate the election results with the City of Angels Chorale doing Dancing in the Streets. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.
Okay, Tokyo!